Be turning our Bibles to Genesis 34. Genesis 34. All right, now which child of Jacob becomes prominent here in this chapter?
Dinah.
Whose daughter was Dinah? Which one? Daughter of Leah. So it says that she went out to visit the daughters of the land. So she went out to see some of the other young ladies. And who saw her? Yeah, Shechem, daughter of Hamor the Hivite. Now this is going to take place kind of in the middle of the land where Shechem is known to be, actually. Sometimes you see names that are names of people but also names of places, and it's probably because the names were named after the people, or at least whether it was this one or somebody else named by that name. We're going to see that also with a couple of descendants of Esau a little bit later. One of the things that's interesting to me in the various circumstances that often involve sin is the phrasing that you see next in verse 2, because it says that Shechem saw her, then he did what? Took her. I just think it's interesting that you see that same kind of terminology in many places where sin is involved. You see it back in Genesis 3. She saw that the fruit was, you know, looked good, and she took it. And so it's that seeing and taking. David did the same thing with Bathsheba. He saw her, he took her. It's that kind of an idea where sin is something that you... basically, you see, you're tempted with, you seize upon it, take it, as it were. And it says that in taking her, in this case, it says that he did rape her. He was deeply attracted to Dinah, it says, and loved the girl and spoke tenderly to her. We might contrast that for just a moment with what happens a little bit later in their history, which son of David did something similar? Amnon took Tamar, and that was his half-sister. But the interesting thing there is that kind of the distinction here is that this says with Shechem that what did he do afterwards? He loved her, he spoke tenderly to her. What did Amnon do, however?
He put the woman out.
Yeah, he despised her afterwards. And so it's just an interesting contrast that you see between the two. So what Shechem did was that he goes to his father, Hamor, and says, get me this young woman as a wife, almost in Samson-like, get me this woman. Jacob hears about this. I don't know how. I don't know what the circumstances were, whether she went and told or somebody witnessed, or I don't know. Where were the sons when Jacob found out? They're out in the field, so they don't hear about it immediately. And Jacob didn't say anything until they came in, it says in verse 5. Hamor went, the father of Shechem went out to Jacob to speak with him. And then the sons come in and they hear about this. And how did they feel about what happened to their sister? They were grieved, angry, because it says that he had done what? Defiled her, but he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by sleeping with Jacob's daughter. And then notice that last phrase there, for such a thing ought not to be done. Now, what's interesting to me about that is that's a very rare statement that you get in a narrative. And a lot of times in narratives, we're simply told what happened, but we don't necessarily get the this was right or wrong or anything like that. Sometimes we're left to make those judgments about that, like when Abraham went down to Egypt, was that right, was that wrong, what are the principles involved here, what happened? We're not told that, but here he's very explicit, for such a thing ought not to be done. And I think that's interesting. If you were later Israel, if you're part of the people later on, and you're hearing these events in Genesis, and or reading them, or however you're getting that information, this is a reminder of the kind of thing that God simply doesn't want done among his people. Well, Hamor spoke with them, it says. Who's he speaking to?
The father,
father and the son. So they're involved here at this point. He says, "The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him in marriage and intermarry with us. Give your daughters to us and take our daughters for yourselves. So you'll live with us and the land shall be open to you. Live and trade in it and acquire property in it." Now, knowing what Shechem did, the disgraceful thing that he did, what does this kind of sound like they're trying to do, maybe? Yeah, whitewash it a little bit, smooth it over a little bit, maybe. Hey, just join us, marry our daughters, and everything will be fine, right? As if, almost as if there's no expectation of anything else to be done here. Now, if you're one of the sons of Jacob and you're hearing this, what are you thinking? You're angry and you're grieved, and you think justice needs to be done somehow. And so the proposal that they're making is not satisfactory to you. Now, they're going to pretend like it is, but that's not what's going to happen as we see here, right? Now, the other thing that's interesting, this idea of intermarrying with us, again, imagine for a moment that you are part of later Israel reading this. What have you been told in the law? You don't intermarry with whom? The people of the land, all right? The Canaanites, the Hivites, the Ammonites, the Perizzites, all of us, all the ites. You don't intermarry with them. Why? What's the concern?
Idolatry.
Yeah, now, because we could back up and say, well, now, wait a minute. What about Rahab? And what about Ruth? And what about these other people? Is that a problem? Well, no, but why not? Because they converted, they changed. In other words, the issue wasn't just, I don't want anybody who's a foreigner. The issue was, the reason I don't want foreigners is because they're idolaters and they're going to defile my people. And so, if you're reading this, you're going to see this, I think, as a, you know, this is something you don't do. So not only do you not do the first thing that ought not to be done, the solution is not to intermarry with the people of the land either. Shechem said to her father and her brothers, "Let me find favor in your sight." Now hold on. "You raped our sister, and you're asking to find favor in our sight. You got to be kidding me." "No." "And I'll give you whatever you tell me," he says. "Demand of me ever so much bridal payment and gift, and I'll give whatever you tell me, but give me the girl in marriage. I'll do whatever you tell me to do, just let me have her in marriage." All right. Now, one of the themes that we see in Genesis pops up again here. And that's the theme of deceit, right? That's a common theme in Genesis, is it not? Did Jacob ever practice deceit? Yes, that's one of his problems, right? So again, did Laban practice deceit? And then Jacob again. Yeah, I mean, it's happening all the time. So when we wonder, well, where do these brothers get these ideas from? Well, they're around it. So Jacob's sons answered Shechem and his father Hamor with deceit. Why? Because he had defiled their sister Dinah. Now, the other thing that intrigues me about that statement is it's not Jacob who answers. It's the brothers. And I just always wonder, but why didn't Jacob speak up here? Is he just being calculated? Is he backing off and thinking about it? Some, what's he doing? But the brothers jump in. They said, "We cannot do this thing, that is, give our sister to a man who is uncircumcised. For that would be a disgrace to us." Now that sounds noble. God commanded circumcision, but bear in mind that they're not saying this because they're really concerned about circumcision right now. They're saying it because that's their in, that's their excuse to be able to get Shechem to agree to the circumstances here. So we can't do that. So we'll consent to you on one condition, he says. If you will become like us, in that every male of you will be circumcised, then we'll give our daughters to you and we'll take your daughters for ourselves and live with you and become one people. But if you do not listen to us to be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and go. Now, I suppose you could say it's a calculated risk, because what if they had said, no, we're not going to do that? Would they have just been happy to take Dinah and go? Well, probably not. They don't appear to be happy with that. They apparently, at least it seems to me, know well enough that Shechem wants her so badly that he's going to be willing to do this. And their words seemed reasonable to Hamor and Shechem. Now, if I'm not Hamor or Shechem, and if I'm hearing this, I'm probably going to think, that's not reasonable. What are you doing? What are you agreeing to here? But the young man did not delay to do this. Why? Because he was delighted with Jacob's day. He just wanted her so badly. And he was more respected than all the household of his father. Now bear in mind, here's a man saying, I'll do whatever it takes. I love her. I want to marry her. You tell me to be circumcised, I'll jump right on. And he's a respected man. But he raped her. Keep that in mind. This is a guy who did this. Carried out a despicable act. But he's respected in his house.
That doesn't mean he was a good man.
No, it does not mean he was a good man. So Hamor and Shechem came to the gate of the city and basically said, all right, these people are friendly to us. So let them live in the land and trade in it for gold. The land is large enough for them. We'll take their daughters in marriage and give our daughters to them. You can imagine if you're one of the guys in the gates of the city, you might be thinking, okay, all right, what's the catch? Well, here's the catch. They'll consent to do this only if every male is circumcised. But notice what he's trying to sell them on here. Verse 23, not only the women, but what? Their livestock and their property will be ours. So is he entirely being respectable here? No. Let's just consent. Let's just do this. It's no big deal. It may hurt for a few days, but we can do this. And, you know, look at all this stuff we'll have. So they listened, and they did it. And they went out of the gate of the city to do this, and everything seemed to be going okay, I guess, until the third day. And it came about on the third day when, why the third day? What's happening?
Pain.
They're in a lot of pain. Okay. If you're an adult male, this is a painful thing. Okay. And they're all in pain. And they're in a position basically where they can't do much. You know, this is not, it's not like you can just pick your sword up and go about and fight and do things like you would normally do. So who came after them? Simeon and Levi. Now whose sons are they? Okay, Leah. So in other words, they're full brothers. So who's the firstborn son? Reuben. He's not listed here. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, then the fourth,
Judah.
All right, so, and Dinah is their full sister. They came upon the city undetected, and what'd they do? Killed every male. And they killed Hamor and Shechem and took Dinah from Shechem's house. So, in other words, Shechem kept Dinah. I'm sure they see this as a rescue operation, but you could tell right here, at least these two had no intention of living with these people, letting them intermarry with their sisters and, you know, all that. They don't have any intention on doing that. And it says they did it because, verse 27, they had defiled their sister. It's just, they just went full-blown Rambo. I mean, it just, you know, I think it's one of those things where, since Hamor and Shechem seem to be kind of the leaders, they're the ones in charge, they're going to hold everybody responsible. And I would imagine there's also fear that if they had just killed Hamor and Shechem, what would the other men of the city have done? Then they had to come after them. Look, nothing about this story is pretty, okay? This is not one of these stories where, look at all the good that's being done. No, everything being done here is bad, all right? Not only did they kill them, they looted the city. They took the flocks, their herds, their donkeys, captured and looted all the wealth in verse 29, and they took the wives and children into captivity with them and everything that was in the houses. So what they're doing here is not good. And Jacob, you know, again, he didn't say anything, or at least nothing we see recorded here earlier, but now he comes to these brothers and says, you brought trouble on me by making me repulsive among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and since my men are few in number, they will band together against me and attack me, and I'll be destroyed, I and my household. So I think from Jacob's perspective, I mean, yeah, they went and they killed all the men of the city, but Jacob is saying, this is more than that. Because you're going to have people around. We've become odious to the people now. They're going to band together. They're going to come after us. And may I suggest here at this point that this is kind of one of the backstories to the notion of why Israel is so hated when they come into the land. Who's going to trust them? And the various enemies are going to come after them. That'd be later, but I think this kind of sets the stage. Again, if you're part of Israel later on and you're reading this, hearing this, what are you going to hear? Hittites, Perizzites, the Canaanites basically are in the land and they're going to come after us. Yeah, and again, I go back to that statement in verse 7, when he's, you know, such a thing ought not to be done. I think that's kind of laying in the backdrop here of everything else that's happening. What the brothers do in deceit, the killing, the taking the wives and the children, and then even Jacob, yeah, his concern is not you have gone against God, it's you've made us odious here. Of course, they respond by saying, well, should he treat our sister like a prostitute? We're going to let him get away with that? So we come to the end of chapter 34, and that's, you know, what good has happened here, right? I think what's happened is we've seen some issues that kind of underlie the animosity that exists between Israel, the people of Israel, and the people of the land. And it's not, the reason that they hate Israel at this point is not because they're righteous people. They've acted in deceit. Now, do they all know the story of what Shechem did to Dinah? I don't know. Would they approve of such a thing? I don't know, but there were some pretty bad people there. And so nothing good is happening right now. Yeah.
Yeah, I know there's two things in this chapter. The son is as deceitful as the father was. And also, God is not mentioned at all in this chapter.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's pretty important for understanding kind of what's going on. That's why I keep saying it. I think we need to see it a little bit from the perspective of later Israel hearing this. Because it's going to matter to them how these events created the circumstances that led to where they would later have their enemies in the land. Yeah.
This is also before the establishment of the law of Moses.
Yeah.
So this is before any law has been set up to condemn certain actions.
Right. But on a moral basis, I do think it's interesting that even prior to the law being written, there is still a concept about the law above the law. In other words, it doesn't take a written law for people to know that raping another human being is wrong, or that killing another human being like this is wrong. It doesn't take, you know, the law of Moses to do that. I think it speaks to the moral fabric of who human beings are, and we know that's just not how you treat people. But that's what they were doing. All right, so as that chapter ends, the next chapter opens with what? God said. Now, there doesn't seem to be much concern for what God said in chapter 34. All around, but God's going to interject himself back in here into the narrative. And where is he going to tell Jacob to go? Rise, go to Bethel, live there, make an altar there to God who appeared to you from when what happened? What event was happening at this point? When you fled from your brother Esau. So that goes back to what chapter? Anybody know?
26.
28. And let's remind ourselves for just a moment. What's going on here? Latter half of chapter 28, Jacob departed Beersheba, that's way down in the south of the land, and went toward Haran, which is up well north of the land. And he happened upon this place, spent the night, and in verse 10, it says, because the sun had set, took one of the stones and made the place, made a support for his head, lay down, and then he had this dream. And what dream did he have? the ladder that went up to heaven. Okay? And angels were ascending and descending upon this ladder. And the Lord was standing above it and said, this is verse 13, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie will give to you and your descendants. So this is the place where God reiterated his promise to Jacob. And so Jacob calls this place what? Bethel, which means house of God. Now, Jacob left the land, and how long was he gone for? 20, 21 years? And now he comes back, and basically God is going to call him back to the place where the promise was made to remind him, because I don't have a lot of confidence that Jacob was doing a lot of great things while he was gone from the land. I mean, God was blessing him, but he was still doing things that, you know, weren't exactly right. And God's going to give him a little fuller revelation, I think, about what he wants. And I see the things that happen here as kind of a turning point for him. Because what's God going to do that's really important here with Jacob? Chapter 35. What's he going to do?
He's
going to change his name from Jacob to Israel. All right, so God says, arise, go to Bethel and live there and make an altar there to God who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau. Jacob said to his household and all who were with him, remove the foreign gods which are among you and purify yourselves and change your... Now, my question is, why didn't he tell him to do this earlier? He's like, now he remembers, oh, well, we shouldn't have these things. Yeah.
Another question is, where did they get the foreign gods?
Well, apparently the house of Laban had them. Yeah.
Well, they've been interacting with the people of the land.
Yeah. Yeah, they could have picked some up there. They could have brought some from Laban. But the point is, Jacob should have said a long time ago, don't bring these things.
Rachel brought God with her.
Yeah, she did. Yeah, she stole some of the ones from her father's house. The other thing to kind of remember here is that, again, reading this from the perspective of later Israel, Bethel is important, but what is Bethel also going to come to stand for later?
Idolatry,
because what happens at Bethel later?
Golden calf.
All right, so who put the golden calves at Dan and Bethel? Jeroboam. But this is a good bit later, okay? It's not going to happen here. I mean, it's going to happen a long time later. But if you were living in the divided kingdom of Israel, you're going to be familiar with this. And Bethel is going to stand for the place where Jeroboam set up the golden calves. But it's not supposed to. It's supposed to stand for the house of God. And the prophets are going to call him out on the name Bethel as well. Go to Bethel, and he says, I'm going to make an altar there to God, in verse 3, who answered me on the day of my distress and has been with me wherever I have gone. So Jacob recognizes God has not abandoned him, even though he hasn't necessarily kept God in mind all the time. He knows he's been blessed by God. So they gave Jacob all the foreign gods, the rings in their ears, and apparently they stood for something like that too. And Jacob hid them under the oak near Shechem, and they journeyed. And wherever they went, what's happening now? Now everybody's scared to death. Now remember, Jacob was a little afraid about what? Being odious in the land, the people are going to kind of band together and come after us, but now God has made it so that as they travel, the people are afraid of them. So they're not going to pursue the sons of Jacob now. which is a little bit like what happens under Joshua when they come into the land as well. The people, you know, their hearts melt out of fear for what happens. So he comes to this Bethel place, which is not too far from Jerusalem, by the way. Built an altar there, and it was because there God had revealed himself to him when he fled from his brother. We're told that Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died, and she was buried below the Bethel under the oak. And then in verse 9, God appeared to Jacob and blessed him. And it mentions Padan Aram, which of course is well up to the north. So again, a kind of traveling that path from north to south. And says, your name is Jacob. Verse 10, you shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name. So he called him Israel, and God also said, I am God Almighty, be fruitful and multiply, a nation and multitude of nations shall come from you, and kings shall come from you, and the land which I gave to Abraham and Isaac I will give to you, and I will give the land to your descendants after you. So then God went up from him at the place where he had spoken with him. So Jacob sets up a memorial stone, and poured out a drink offering on it, poured oil on it, and Jacob named the place where God had spoken with him Bethel. So again, it's a reiteration, kind of a reaffirmation. This is the place. This is the stone. Back before he had set up a stone, but to sleep on it. Now he sets up a stone as a pillar and says, this is the place of God. What does Israel mean? Anybody know?
No, I've forgotten.
Okay.
I believe it's those who struggle with God.
Struggle with God, or those who struggle with God. Which is interesting, because when did God first actually say he would change his name? Or indicate of this? Yeah, back in chapter 32, well, what it says is that, after he wrestles with him and his hip socket was dislocated, he says, what's your name? He says, well, your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel, for you've contended with God and men and have prevailed. So Jacob had a permanent limp as a reminder of that struggle with God. Now, I won't go into all the things about why God let him win that struggle, but I think it's just interesting that God bears with him through the trials and the tribulations and the difficulties and the times where Jacob isn't really thinking right. Jacob has been struggling with God all along, hasn't he? Do we ever feel that way? So Israel is going to be an appropriate reminder of that. Yeah.
I don't think God left Jacob win completely, because he touched his socket and lived the rest of his life.
Well, yeah, but I think, you know, I mean, if God wanted to, he could have just said, you're dead. I mean, you know, it's not like it was actually a fight for God. He couldn't do it. But I think it's kind of one of those reminders that God lets us struggle sometimes. But even though we might come through it, we might come through it with a limp, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's, I think, a debate. But struggle is also one of the... questions. But I do think it's interesting that the struggle and Prince is appropriate as well, because God's going to make these people his top people, if you will. All right, so the memorial stone is set up, and he calls it Bethel once again. They journeyed on from there to Ephrath. Rachel began to give birth, and what happens? She dies giving birth, and who's the one that's born?
Benjamin.
So Jacob buries her, sets up a memorial, and then they continue to journey. So now... You have more bad things that happen. What does Reuben do? Goes to his father's concubine, Bilhah, and Israel heard about it. It's interesting to me that, you know, it says Israel here. It's obviously talking about Jacob. Later, Israel's going to become the joint name for all the people, right? So he heard about it, and, you know, sometimes we wonder, why is it when the promise was made that kings would come forth from him, who's the one, who's the son through whom the kings would come?
Judah.
And I often wonder about that. Why Judah? Because he's not the firstborn. But look at what Reuben did. And look at what Simeon and Levi did. Now, there's going to be a question about Judah, because look at what Judah is going to do in chapter 38. But he's going to redeem himself. But that's later. Yeah.
I think the fact that Reuben later with his father's concubine, he lost his birthright.
Yeah.
Since he was the oldest.
Yeah, he had the birthright, yeah. But the interesting thing about that is, who does Israel or Jacob actually treat as the one with the birthright? Joseph. Yeah, Joseph gets the double portion. All right, so we come to the end of chapter 35, and now who dies? Isaac dies. We thought he was dead a long time ago, didn't we? He thought he was. But he's been, you know, carried along all this time. We haven't heard anything from him. But he dies, and Esau and Jacob work together to bury him. Now, chapter 36, and we'll just touch upon this briefly. Who does Esau marry? Well, we don't need names right now, but where are they from?
Canaan.
Daughters of Canaan. Now, remember that Esau's marrying Hittites gave Isaac and Rebekah, you know, a lot of sorrow. I mean, that was grief for them. But he continues to do this, and then he's going to leave or depart from the Y. He's going to go to Mount Seir, which is basically Edom, south of the Dead Sea. Why is he going to go there? Yeah, it's Lot and Abraham all over again, isn't it? Go down to Sodom and Gomorrah, which happens to be down in that same essential region of the Dead Sea. Esau goes down there. The possessions were too great. They couldn't live together, so they depart. And then it tells us that Esau is who?
Edom.
Now, why is that important to the overall narrative of the Bible? Because Edom, the Edomites, are one of the primary enemies of Israel later. Okay? So that's important that we see that. And again, if you're reading this later, hearing this later, this is an important detail. We're told then of the descendants of Esau. There's a genealogical record here. Some of the kings that are in the land during this time and all that. We won't go through all the names or anything like that, but I do think it's interesting that there's a couple names in here that are significant, particularly because we've just finished studying what book? So what names stick out?
Eliphaz.
And the son of Eliphaz was Teman, but yet in Job, Teman is a place. So is it, I'm not saying the Eliphaz here is the same Eliphaz as in Job. I'm not saying that. But I do think it's interesting that we have the names associated with that territory. Teman, Eliphaz, Timnah, and so on. So are these names derived from the people in Job, or the people in Job's name derived from, we don't know. We don't know. But apparently that's there might be some connection there. All right, we're out of time. Who has the... All right, Matthew, we'll turn that over to you. There are worksheets in the back for next week.